I am confident that we can restore service shortly. We have skilled bridging engineers, you know.
Luo, Xian said, your magic army bridges can support a tank or a truck, yes. But not a locomotive that weighs 200 tons pulling a train weighing 4,000. Now what else has gone wrong with your Siberian adventure?
It is foolish to think that the other side will simply lie down and die. Of course they fight back. But we have superior forces in theater, and we will smash them. We will have that new gold mine in our pocket before this meeting is over, the defense minister promised.
But the pledge seemed hollow to some of those around the table.
What else? Xian persisted.
The American Naval Air Forces attacked last night and succeeded in sinking some of our South Sea Fleet units.
Which units?
Well, we have no word from our missile submarine, and...
They sank our only missile submarine? Premier Xu asked. How is this possible? Was it sitting in harbor?
No, Luo admitted. It was at sea, in company with another nuclear submarine. And that one is also possibly lost.
Marvelous, Tong Jie observed. Now the Americans strike at our strategic assets. That's half our nuclear deterrent gone, and that was the safe half of it. What goes on, Luo? What is happening now?
At his seat, Fang Gan took note of the fact that Zhang was strangely subdued. Ordinarily, he would have leapt to Luo's defense, but except for the one conciliatory comment, he was leaving the defense minister to flap in the wind. What might that mean?
What do we tell the people? Fang asked, trying to center the meeting on something important.
The people will believe what they are told, Luo said. And everyone nodded nervous agreement on that one. They did control the media. The American CNN News Service had been turned off all over the People's Republic, along with all Western news services, even in Hong Kong, which usually enjoyed much looser reins than the rest of the country. But the thing no one addressed, but everyone knew to worry about, was that every soldier had a mother and a father who'd notice when the mail home stopped coming. Even in a nation as tightly controlled as the PRC, you couldn't stop the truth from getting out. Or rumors, which, though false, could be even worse than an adverse truth. People would believe things other than those they were told to believe, if those other things made more sense than the official truth proclaimed by their government in Beijing. Truth was something so often feared in this room, Fang realized, and for the first time in his life he wondered why that had to be. If the truth was something to fear, might that mean they were doing something wrong in here? But no, that couldn't be true, could it? Didn't they have a perfect political model for reality? Wasn't that Mao's bequest to their country? But if that were true, why did they fear having the people find out what was really happening? Could it be that they, the Politburo members, could handle the truth, and the peasantry could not? But then, if they feared having the peasantry get hold of the truth, didn't that have to mean that the truth was harmful to the people sitting in this room? And if the truth was a danger to the peasants and workers, then didn't they have to be wrong? Fang suddenly realized how dangerous was the thought that had just entered his mind.
Luo, what does it mean to us strategically, the Interior Minister asked, if the Americans remove half of our strategic weapons? Was that done deliberately? If so, for what cause?
Tong, you do not sink a ship by accident. And so, yes, the attack on our missile submarine must have been a deliberate act, Luo answered.
So the Americans deliberately removed from the table one of our only methods for attacking them directly?
Why?
Was that not a political act, not just a military one?
The defense minister nodded.
Yes, you could see it that way.
Can we expect the Americans to strike at us directly?
To this date they have struck some bridges, but what about our government and vital industries?
Might they strike directly at us? Tong went on.
That would be unwise. We have missiles targeted at their principal cities. They know this. Since they disarmed themselves of nuclear missiles some years ago,
Well, they still have nuclear bombs that can be delivered by bombers and tactical aircraft, of course, but not the ability to strike at us in the way that we could strike at them. And the Russians, of course. How sure are we that they are disarmed? Tong persisted. If they have ballistic arms, they've concealed it from everyone, Tan Deshi told them all. Then he shook his head decisively. No, they have no more. And that gives us an advantage, doesn't it? Zhang asked, with a ghoulish smile. USS Gettysburg was alongside the floating pier in the York River. Once the warheads for Trident missiles had been stored here, and there must still have been some awaiting dismantlement, because there were Marines to be seen, and only Marines were entrusted to guard the Navy's nuclear weapons. But none of those were on the pier. No, the trucks that rolled out from the weapons depot were carrying long, square cross-sectioned boxes that contained SM-2ER Block 4D surface-to-air missiles. When the trucks got to the cruiser, a traveling crane lifted them up to the foredeck of the ship, where, with the assistance of some strong-backed sailors, the boxes were rapidly lowered into the vertical launch cells of the forward missile launcher. It took about 4 minutes per box, Gregory saw, with the captain pacing his wheelhouse all the while. Gregory knew why. He had an order to take his cruiser right to Washington, D.C., and the order had the word expedite on it. Evidently, expedite was a word with special meaning for the United States Navy, like having your wife call for you from the baby's room at 2 in the morning. The 10th box was duly lowered, and the crane swung clear of the ship. Mr. Richardson, Captain Blandy said to the officer of the deck. Yes, sir, the lieutenant answered. Let's get underway. Gregory walked out on the bridge wing to watch. The special sea detail cast off the 6-inch hawsers, and scarcely had they fallen clear of the cleats on the main deck when the cruiser's auxiliary power unit started pushing the 10,000 tons of gray steel away from the floating pier. And the ship was for sure in a hurry. She was not 15 feet away when the main engine started turning, and less than a minute after that Gregory heard the whoosh of the 4 jet turbines taking a big gulp of air, and he could feel the ship accelerate for the Chesapeake Bay, almost like being on a city transit bus. Dr. Gregory? Captain Blandy had stuck his head out the pilot house door. Yeah, Captain? You want to get below and do your software magic on our birds? You bet. He knew the way, and in 3 minutes was at the computer terminal which handled that task. Hey, Doc, Senior Chief Leak said, sitting down next to him. All ready? I'm supposed to help. Okay, you can watch, I suppose. The only problem was that it was a clunky system, about as user-friendly as a chainsaw. But, as Leak had told him a week before, this was the flower of 1975 technology, back when an Apple II with 64K of RAM was the cat's own ass. Now he had more computing power in his wristwatch. Each missile had to be upgraded separately, and each was a 7-step process. Hey, wait a minute, Gregory objected. The screen wasn't right. Doc, we loaded 6 Block 4D. The other 2 are stock SM-2ER Block 3C radar homers. What can I tell you? Captain Blandy's conservative. So I only do the upgrade on holes 1 through 6? No, do 'em all. It'll just ignore the changes you made to the infrared homing code. The chips on the birds can handle the extra code, no sweat. Right, Mr. Olson? Correct, Senior Chief, Lieutenant Olson confirmed. The missiles are current technology, even if the computer system isn't. It probably costs more to make missile seeker heads with current technology that can talk to this old kludge than it would to buy a new gateway to upgrade the whole system, not to mention having a more reliable system overall. But you'll have to talk to NAVSEA about that. Who? Gregory asked. Naval Sea Systems Command. They're the technical geniuses who won't put stabilizers on these cruisers. They think it's good for us to puke in a seaway. Feather merchants, Leak explained. Navy's full of 'em, on land anyway. The ship heeled strongly to starboard. Captain's in a hurry, ain't he? Gregory observed.
Gettysburg was making a full-speed right-angle turn to port. "Well, Sacklant said it's the SecDef's idea. I guess that makes it important," Mr. Olson told their guest.
"I think this is imprudent," Fung told them all.
"Why is that?" Luo asked.
"Is fueling the missiles necessary? Is there not a danger of provocation?"
"I suppose this is a technical matter," Qian said. "As I recall, once you fuel them, you cannot keep them fueled for more than, what, 12 hours?
The technocrat caught the defense minister off guard with that question. He didn't know the answer.
"I will have to consult with Second Artillery for that," he admitted.
"So then, you will not prepare them for launch until we have a chance to consider the matter?" Qian asked.
"Why, of course not," Luo promised.
"And so the real problem is, how do we tell the people what has transpired in Siberia?"
"The people will believe what we tell them to believe," Luo said yet again.
"Comrades," Qian said, struggling to keep his voice reasonable, "we cannot conceal the rising of the sun. Neither can we conceal the loss of our rail transport system. Nor can we conceal the large-scale loss of life. Every soldier has parents, and when enough of them realize their son is lost, they will speak of it, and the word will get out.
We must face facts here. It is better, I think, to tell the people that there is a major battle going on, and there has been loss of life. To proclaim that we are winning when we may not be is dangerous for all of us."
"You say the people will rise up?" Tong Jie asked.
"No, but I say there could be dissatisfaction and unrest. And it is in our collective interest to avoid that, is it not?"
Qian asked the assembly.
"How will the adverse information get out?" Luo asked.
"It frequently does," Qian told them.
"We can prepare for it and mitigate the effect of adverse information, or we can try to withstand it. The former offers mild embarrassment to us. The latter, if it fails, could be more serious. The TV will show what we wish them to show, and the people will see nothing else. Besides, General Ping and his army group are advancing even as we speak."
"What do they call it?"
This one's Grace Kelly. The other two are Marilyn Monroe and... I can't remember," General Moore said. "Anyway, they named them for movie stars."
"And how do they transmit?"
"The Dark Star uploads directly to a communications satellite, encrypted, of course, and we distribute it out of Fort Belvoir."
"So we can send it out any way we want?"
"Yes, sir."
"Okay, Ed, the Chinese are telling their people what?"
"They started off by saying the Russians committed a border intrusion and they counterattacked. They're also saying that they're kicking Ivan's ass."
"Well, that's not true. And it'll be especially untrue when they reach the Russian stop line. That Bondarenko guy's really played his cards beautifully. They're pretty strung out. We've chopped their supply line for fair, and they're heading into a real motherfucker of an ambush," the DCI told them.
"How about it, General?"
"The Chinese just don't know what's ahead of them. You know, out at the NTC we keep teaching people that he who wins the reconnaissance battle wins the war. The Russians know what's happening. The Chinese do not. My God, this Dark Star has really exceeded our expectations."
"It's some shiny new toy, Mickey," Jackson agreed. "Like going to a Vegas casino when you're able to read the cards halfway through the deck. You just can't hardly lose this way."
The president leaned forward.
"You know, one of the reasons we took it on the chin with Vietnam is how the people got to see the war every night on Huntley-Brinkley. How will it affect the Chinese if their people see the war the same way, but live this time?"
"The battle that's coming? It'll shake them up a lot," Ed Foley thought.
"But how do we..." Oh, yeah.
"Holy shit, Jack, are you serious?"
"Can we do it?" Ryan asked.
"Technically, it's child's play. My only beef is that it really lets people know one of our capabilities. This is sensitive stuff. I mean, right up there with the performance of our reconnaissance satellites. It's not the sort of thing you just let out." Why not? Hell, couldn't some university duplicate the optics? The president asked. Well, yeah, I guess. The imagery systems are good, but they're not all that new a development, except some of the thermal systems, but even so. Ed, let's say we can shock them into stopping the war. How many lives would it save? Quite a few, the DCI admitted. Thousands. Maybe tens of thousands. Including some of our people? Yes, Jack, including some of ours. And from a technical point of view, it's really child's play? Yes, it's not technically demanding at all. Then turn the children loose, Ed. Right now, Ryan ordered. Yes, Mr. President. Chapter 59, Loss of Control. With the death of General Peng, command of 34th Shock Army devolved to Major General Gay Lee, CG also of 302nd Armored. His first task was to get himself clear, and this he did, ordering his tank off the long gun range slope while one of the surviving reconnaissance tracks recovered Peng's body. All of those tracked vehicles also pulled back, as Gay figured his first task was to determine what had happened, rather than to avenge the death of his army commander. It took him 20 minutes to motor back to his own command section, where he had a command track identical to the one Peng had driven about him. He needed the radios, since he knew the field phones were down. For whatever reason, he didn't know. "I need to talk to Marshal Luo," he said over the command frequency, which was relayed back to Beijing via several repeater stations. It took another 10 minutes because the defense minister, he was told, was in a Politburo meeting. Finally, the familiar voice came over the radio. "This is Marshal Luo. This is Major General Gay Li, commanding 302nd Armored. General Peng Shiwang is dead," he announced. "What happened?" "He went forward to join the reconnaissance section to see the front, and he was killed by a sniper bullet. The recon section ran into a small ambush. Looked like a single Russian personnel carrier. I drove it off with my own tank," Gay went on. It was fairly true, and it seemed like the sort of thing he was supposed to say. "I see. What is the overall situation?" the defense minister asked. 34th Shock Army is advancing. Well, it was. I paused the advance to reorganize the command group. I request instructions, Comrade Minister. You will advance and capture the Russian gold mine, secure it, and then continue north for the oil field. Very well, Comrade Minister, but I must advise you that 29th Army, right behind us, sustained a serious attack an hour ago, and was reportedly badly hit. How badly? I do not know. Reports are sketchy, but it doesn't sound good. What sort of attack was it? An air attack. Origin unknown. As I said, reports are very sketchy at this time. 29th seems very disorganized at the moment, Gay reported. Very well. You will continue the attack. 43rd Army is behind 29th and will support you. Watch your left flank. I know of the reports of Russian units to my west, Gay said. I will orient a mechanized division to deal with that, but...
But what?
Luo asked.
But, Comrade Marshal, we have no reconnaissance information on what lies before us. I need such information in order to advance safely.
You will find your safety in advancing rapidly into enemy territory and destroying whatever formations you find, Luo told him forcefully. Continue your advance.
By your command, Comrade Minister.
There wasn't much else he could say to that.
Report back to me as necessary.
I will do that, Gay promised.
Very well. Out.
Static replaced the voice.
You heard him, Gay said to Colonel Hua Chenggong, whom he'd just inherited as Army Operations Officer.
Now what, Colonel?
We continue the advance, Comrade General.
Gay nodded to the logic of the situation.
Give the order.
It took hold 4 minutes later, when the radio commands filtered down to battalion level and the units started moving.
They didn't need reconnaissance information now, Colonel Waugh reasoned. They knew that there had to be some light Russian units just beyond the ridgeline where Pang had met his foolish death.
"Didn't I warn him?" Waugh raged to himself. "Didn't Gay warn him?"
For a general to die in battle was not unexpected. But to die from a single bullet fired by some lone rifleman was worse than foolish. 30 years of training and experience wasted, lost to a single rifleman.
"There they go again," Major Tucker said, seeing the plume of diesel exhaust followed by the lurching of numerous armored vehicles. "About 6 kilometers from your first line of tanks."
"A pity we can't get one of these terminals to Sinyavsky," Bondarenko said.
"Not that many of them, sir," Tucker told him. "Sun Microsystems is still building them for us."
"That was General Gay Lee," Luo told the Politburo. "We've had some bad luck. General Peng is dead, killed by a sniper bullet, I just learned."
"How did that happen?" Premier Xu asked.
"Peng had gone forward, as a good general should, and there was a lucky Russian out there with a rifle," the defense minister explained.
Then one of his aides appeared and walked to the marshal's seat, handing him a slip of paper. He scanned it.
"This is confirmed?"
"Yes, Comrade Marshal. I requested and got confirmation myself. The ships are in sight of land even now."
"What ships? What land?" Xu asked.
It was unusual for him to take an active part in these meetings. Usually he let the others talk, listened passively, and then announced the consensus conclusions reached by the others.
"Comrade," Luo answered, "it seems some American warships are bombarding our coast near Guangzhou."
"Bombarding?" Xu asked. "You mean with guns?"
"That's what the report says, yes."
"Why would they do that?" the Premier asked, somewhat nonplussed by this bit of information.
"To destroy shore emplacements and—"
"Isn't that what one does prior to invading? A preparation to putting troops on the beach?" Foreign Minister Shan asked.
"Well, yes, it could be that, I suppose," Luo replied, "but—"
"Invasion?" Xu asked.
"A direct attack on our own soil?"
"Such a thing is most unlikely," Luo told them. "They lack the ability to put troops ashore in sufficiently large numbers. America simply doesn't have the troops to do such a—"
"What if they get assistance from Taiwan? How many troops do the bandits have?" Tong Jie asked.
"Well, they have some land forces," Luo allowed. "But we have ample ability to—"
"You told us a week ago that we had all the forces required to defeat the Russians, even if they got some aid from America," Xian observed, becoming agitated.
"What fiction do you have for us now, Luo?"
"Fiction?"
the marshal's voice boomed.
"I tell you the facts, but now you accuse me of that?"
"What have you not told us, Luo?" Xian asked harshly. "We are not peasants here to be told what to believe."
"The Russians are making a stand. They have fought back. I told you that. And I told you this sort of thing is to be expected, and it is. We fight a war with the Russians. It's not a burglary in an unoccupied house. This is an armed contest between 2 major powers. And we will win because we have more and better troops. They do not fight well. We swept aside their border defenses, and we've pursued their army north. And they didn't have the manhood to stand and fight for their own land. We will smash them. Yes, they will fight back. We must expect that. But it won't matter. We will smash them, I tell you," he insisted. "Is there any information which you have not told us to this point?" Interior Minister Tong asked, in a voice more reasonable than the question itself.
"I have appointed Major General Gay to assume command of the 34th Shock Army. He reported to me that 29th Army sustained a serious air attack earlier today. The effects of this attack are not clear. Probably they managed to damage communications. And an air attack cannot seriously hurt a large mechanized land force. The tools of war do not permit such a thing."
"Now what?" Premier Xu asked. I propose that we adjourn the meeting and allow Minister Luo to return to his task of managing our armed forces, Zhang Hansan proposed, and that we reconvene, say, at 16 hours. There were nods around the table. Everyone wanted the time to consider the things that they'd heard this morning, and perhaps to give the defense minister the chance to make good his words. Xu did a head count and stood. Very well, we adjourn until this afternoon. The meeting broke up in an unusually subdued manner, without the usual pairing off and pleasantries between old comrades. Outside the conference room, Qian buttonholed Fang again. Something is going badly wrong. I can feel it. How sure are you of that? Fang, I don't know what the Americans have done to my railroad bridges, but I assure you that to destroy them, as I was informed earlier this morning, is no small thing. Moreover, the destruction inflicted was deliberately systematic. The Americans, it must have been the Americans, deliberately crippled our ability to supply our field armies. You only do such a thing in preparation to smashing them. And now the commanding general of our advancing armies is suddenly killed. Stray bullets, my ass. That Tset-Ha-Tset-Ha Luo leads us to disaster, Fang. We'll know more this afternoon, Fang suggested, leaving his colleague and going to his office. Arriving there, he dictated another segment for his daily journal. For the first time, he wondered if it might turn out to be his testament. For her part, Ming was disturbed by her minister's demeanor. An elderly man, he'd always nonetheless been a calm and optimistic one for the most part. His mannerisms were those of a grandfatherly gentleman, even when taking her or one of the other office girls to his bed. It was an endearing quality, one of the reasons the office staff didn't resist his advances more vigorously. And besides, he did take care of those who took care of his needs. This time she took her dictation quietly, while he leaned back in his chair, his eyes closed, and his voice a monotone. It took half an hour, and she went out to her desk to do the transcription. It was time for the midday meal by the time she was done, and she went out to lunch with her co-worker, Chai. "What is the matter with him?" she asked Ming. "The meeting this morning did not go well. Fang is concerned with the war." "But isn't it going well? Isn't that what they say on TV?" "It seems there have been some setbacks. This morning they argued about how serious they were. Qian was especially exercised about it, because the Americans attacked our rail bridges in Harbin and Bayan." "Ah." Chai shoveled some rice into her mouth with her chopsticks. "How is Fang taking it?" "He seems very tense. Perhaps he will need some comfort this evening." "Oh? Well, I can take care of him. I need a new office chair anyway," she added with a giggle. Lunch dragged on longer than usual. Clearly their minister didn't need any of them for the moment, and Ming took the time to walk about on the street to gauge the mood of the people there. The feeling was strangely neutral. She was out just long enough to trigger her computer's downtime activation, and though the screen was blank, in the auto-sleep mode, the hard drive started turning, and silently activated the onboard modem. Mary Pat Foley was in her office, though it was past midnight, and she was logging onto her mail account every 15 minutes, hoping for something new from Zorga.
"You've got mail," the mechanical voice told her.
"Yes," she said back to it, downloading the document at once. Then she lifted the phone. "Get Sears up here." With that done, Mrs. Foley looked at the time entry on the email. It had gone out in the early afternoon in Beijing. What might that mean, she wondered, afraid that any irregularity could spell the death of Songbird and the loss of the Zorga documents. "Working late?" Sears asked on entering. "Who isn't?" MP responded. She held out the latest printout. "Read."
Politburo meeting in the morning for a change, Sears said, scanning the first page.
Looks a little raucous. This Chun guy is raising a little hell.
Oh, okay, he chatted with Fong after it and expressed serious concerns. Agreed to meet later in the day and...
Oh, shit.
What's that?
They discussed increasing their readiness of their ICBM force.
Let's see.
Nothing firm was decided for technical reasons. They weren't sure how long they could keep the missiles fueled, but they were shook by our takeout of their missile submarine.
Write that up. I'm going to hang a critic on it, the DDO announced.
Critic, shorthand for critical, is the highest priority in the United States government for message traffic. A critic-flagged document must be in the president's hands no less than 15 minutes after being generated. That meant that Joshua Sears had to get it drafted just as quickly as he could type in his keyboard, and that made for errors in translation. Ryan had been asleep for maybe 40 minutes when the phone next to his bed went off.
Yeah?
Mr. President, some faceless voice announced in the White House Office of Signals, we have critic traffic for you.
All right, bring it up.
Jack swung his body across the bed and planted his feet on the rug. As a normal human being living in his home, he wasn't a bathrobe person. Ordinarily, he'd just pad around his house barefoot in his underwear. But that wasn't allowed anymore, and he always kept a long blue robe handy now. It was a gift from long ago, when he'd taught history at the Naval Academy, a gift from the students there, and bore on the sleeves the one wide and four narrow stripes of a fleet admiral. So dressed, and wearing leather slippers that also came with the new job, he walked out into the upstairs corridor. The Secret Service night team was already up and moving. Joe Hilton came to him first.
We heard, sir. It's on the way up now.
Ryan, who'd been existing on less than 5 hours of sleep per night for the past week, had an urgent need to lash out and rip the face off someone, anyone. But, of course, he couldn't do that to men who were just doing their job, with miserable hours of their own. Special Agent Charlie Malone was at the elevator. He took the folder from the messenger and trotted over to Ryan. Ryan rubbed his hand over his face as he flipped the folder open. The first three lines jumped into his consciousness.
Oh, shit.
Anything wrong? Hilton asked.
Phone, Ryan said.
This way, sir. Hilton led him to the Secret Service upstairs cubbyhole office. Ryan lifted the phone and said, Mary Pat at Langley.
It didn't take long.
MP, Jack here. What gives?
It's just what you see. They're talking about fueling their intercontinental missiles. At least two of them are aimed at Washington.
Great. Now what?
I just tasked a KH-11 to give their launch sites a close look.
There's two of them, Jack. The one we need to look at is at Chuanhua. That's about 40 degrees, 38 minutes north, 115 degrees, 6 minutes east. 12 silos with CCC-4 missiles inside. This is one of the newer ones, and it replaced older sites that stored the missiles in caves or tunnels. Straight, vertical, in-the-ground silos. The entire missile field is about 6 miles by 6 miles. The silos are well separated so that a single nuclear impact can't take out any two missiles, MP explained, manifestly looking at overheads of the place as she spoke.
How serious is this?
A new voice came on the line.
Jack, it's Ed. We have to take this one seriously. The naval bombardment on their coast might have set them off. The damn fools think we might be attempting a no-shit invasion.
What?
What with? The president demanded.
They can be very insular thinkers, Jack, and they're not always logical by our rules, Ed Foley told him.
Great. Okay, you two come on down here. Bring your best China guy with you.
On the way, the DCI replied.
Ryan hung up and looked at Joe Hilton.
Wake everybody up. The Chinese may be going squirrely on us.
The drive up the Potomac River hadn't been easy. Captain Blandy hadn't wanted to wait for a river pilot to help guide him up the river. Naval officers tend to be overly proud when it comes to navigating their ships, and that had made it quite tense for the bridge watch. Rarely was the channel more than a few hundred yards wide, and cruisers are deep-water ships, not riverboats. Once they came within a few yards of a mudbank, but the navigator got them clear of it with a timely rudder order. The ship's radar was up and running. People were actually afraid to turn off the billboard system because it, like most mechanical contrivances, preferred operation to idleness, and switching it off might have broken something. As it was, the RF energy radiating from the four huge billboard transmitters on Gettysburg superstructure had played hell with numerous television sets on the way northwest. But that couldn't be helped. And probably nobody noticed the cruiser in the river anyway. Not at this time of night. Finally, Gettysburg glided to a halt within sight of the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, and had to wait for traffic to be halted on the D.C. Beltway. This resulted in the usual road rage, but at this time of night there weren't that many people to be outraged, though one or two did honk their horns when the ship passed through the open drawbridge span. Perhaps they were New Yorkers, Captain Blandy thought. From there it was another turn to starboard into the Anacostia River, through another drawbridge, this one named for John Philip Sousa, accompanied by more surprised looks from the few drivers out, and then a gentle docking alongside the pier that was also home to USS Barry, a retired destroyer relegated to museum status. The line handlers on the pier, Captain Blandy saw, were mainly civilians. Wasn't that a hell of a thing? The Evolution, that, Gregory had learned, was what the Navy called parking a boat, had been interesting but unremarkable to observe, though the skipper looked quite relieved to have it all behind him. Finished with engines, the CO told the engine room, and let out a long breath, shared, Gregory could see, by the entire bridge crew. Captain? The retired Army officer asked. Yes? What is this all about, exactly? Well, isn't it kind of obvious? Blandy responded. We have a shooting war with the Chinese. They have ICBMs, and I suppose the SecDef wants to be able to shoot them down if they loft one at Washington. SACLAND is also sending an Aegis to New York, and I'd bet Pacific Fleet has some looking out for Los Angeles and San Francisco. Probably Seattle, too. There's a lot of ships there anyway, and a good weapons locker. Do you have spare copies of your software? Sure. Well, we'll have a phone line from the dock in a few minutes. We'll see if there's a way for you to upload it to other interested parties. Oh, Dr. Gregory observed quietly. He really should have thought that one all the way through.
This is Red Wolf 4. I have visual contact with the Chinese advance guard, the regimental commander called on the radio. About 10 kilometers south of us.
Very well, Sinyovsky replied. Just where Bondarenko and his American helpers said they were. Good. There were two other general officers in his command post, the CGs of 201st and 80th Motor Rifle Divisions, and the commander of the 34th was supposed to be on his way as well, though 94th had turned and reoriented itself to attack east from a point about 30 kilometers to the south. Sinyovsky took the old, sodden cigar from his mouth and tossed it out into the grass, pulling another from his tunic pocket and lighting it. It was a Cuban cigar, and superb in its mildness. His artillery commander was on the other side of the map table, just a couple of planks on sawhorses, which was perfect for the moment. Close by were holes dug should the Chinese send some artillery fire their way, and, most important of all, the wires which led to his communication station, set a full kilometer to the west. That was the first thing the Chinese would try to shoot at, because they'd expect him to be there. In fact, the only humans present were 4 officers and 7 sergeants, in armored personnel carriers dug into the ground for safety. It was their job to repair anything the Chinese might manage to break.
So, comrades, they come right into our parlor, eh?
he said for those around him. Sinyavsky had been a soldier for 26 years. Oddly, he was not the son of a soldier. His father was an instructor in geology at Moscow State University. But ever since the first war movie he'd seen, this was the profession he'd craved to join. He'd done all the work, attended all the schools, studied history with the manic attention common in the Russian army, and the Red Army before it. This would be his Battle of the Kursk Bulge, remembering the battle where Vatutin and Rokossovsky had smashed Hitler's last attempt to retake the offensive in Russia, where his mother country had begun the long march that had ended at the Reich Chancellery in Berlin. There, too, the Red Army had been the recipient of brilliant intelligence information, letting them know the time, place, and character of the German attack, and so allowing them to prepare so well that even the best of the German field commanders, Erich von Manstein, could do no more than break his teeth on the Russian steel. "And so it will be here," Sinyavsky promised himself. The only unsatisfactory part was that he was stuck here in this camouflaged tent instead of in the line with his men. But no, he wasn't a captain anymore, and his place was here, to fight the battle on a goddamned printed map. "Red Wolf, you will commence firing when the advance guard gets to within 800 meters. 800 meters, Comrade General," the commander of his tank regiment acknowledged. "I can see them quite clearly now." "What exactly can you see?" "It appears to be a battalion-strength formation, principally Type 90 tanks, some Type 98s, but not too many of those, spread out as though they went to sub-unit commanders. Numerous tracked personnel carriers. I do not see any artillery-spotting vehicles, however." "What do we know of their artillery?" "It's rolling, not set up for firing." "We're watching them," Sinyavsky assured him. "Excellent. They are now 2 kilometers off by my rangefinder." "Stand by." "I will do that, Command." "I hate waiting," Sinyavsky commented to the officers around him. They all nodded, having the same prejudice. He hadn't seen Afghanistan in his younger years, having served mainly in 1st and 2nd Guards tank armies in Germany back then, preparing to fight against NATO, an event which, blessedly, had never taken place. This was his very first experience with real combat, and it hadn't really started yet, and he was ready for it to start. "Okay, if they light those missiles up, what can we do about it?" Ryan asked. "If they launch them, there's not a goddamn thing but run for cover," Secretary Brentano said. "That's good for us. We'll all get away. What about the people who live in Washington, New York, and all the other supposed targets?" POTUS asked. "I've ordered some Aegis cruisers to the likely targets that are near the water," Thunder went on. "I had one of my people from TRW look at the possibility of upgrading the missile systems to see if they might do an intercept. He's done the theoretical work, and he says it looks good on the simulators. But that's a ways from a practical test, of course. It's better than nothing, though." "Okay, where are the ships?" "There's one here now," Brentano answered. "Oh, when did that happen?" Robbie Jackson asked. "Less than an hour ago. Gettysburg. There's another one going to New York, and San Francisco and Los Angeles. Also Seattle, though that's not really a target as far as we know. The software upgrade is going out to them to get their missiles reprogrammed." "Okay, that's something. What about taking those missiles out before they can launch?" Ryan asked next.